HanselMinutes.com. It's Hansel Minutes, a weekly discussion with web developer and technologist Scott Hanselman, hosted by Carl Franklin. This is Lawrence Ryan announcing show number 67, recorded live Wednesday, May 30th, 2007. Support for Hansel Minutes is provided by Telerik RAD Controls, the most comprehensive suite of components for Windows Forms and ASP.NET web applications. Online at www.telerik.com. And by .NET Developers Journal, the world's leading .NET developer magazine. Online at www.sys-con.com. In this fourth episode of Hansel and Minutia, Scott and Carl discuss recent technology changes and upgrades.
Hi, this is Carl Franklin. You're listening to Hansel Minutes from HanselMinutes.com. Here I am with Scott Hanselman. How you doing, Scott?
I'm well. Yourself?
I'm great, thanks. And this show is another Hansel Minutia. We were deciding what to do and what to talk about, and there's just too many little things that are kind of newsworthy happening.
Yeah, right? I mean, we'll get back into some .NET stuff next week, but it seemed to me that there were so many things that could be talked about that were not necessarily worth 20 minutes of our time, but you know, it's an interesting week.
Let's talk about Apple first.
Okay.
Because there's at least three things about Apple that we should talk about.
I guess they went DRM-free today for EMI music. I just fired up iTunes on my box and was told that iTunes 7.2 appeared.
Today being May 30th, the recording date.
Ah, right. This is a Wednesday.
Yeah.
And when you log in, they automatically detect what music on your system is from the EMI publishing group, and they give you the opportunity for 30 cents a song to upgrade them to 256K DRM-free AAC.
Now, in other words, just straight copies, no copy protection, no anything
right.
like that.
Straight AAC. This would mean that my wife's Zune would be able to listen to the EMI music from my library.
EMI's taking a bold step there by announcing their DRM-free. They basically seen the demise of DRM and eroding people's confidence in people's purchasing habits and forcing people to pirate music. I think this is what happens. You know, the industry's waking up to the fact that DRM doesn't work.
Well, they just don't want to be on the wrong side of history. And I know that DRM's caused me a number of headaches over the years. I've a couple of times I've had to call Apple because I hit that 5 computers authorization limit.
Right.
Because I've upgraded a machine and I forgot to deauthorize the computer before. And I've always had that kind of question in my mind that, you know, what happens if iTunes or Apple goes away or if some new format comes out and I've got all these songs that are trapped in my existing format. So it's a start, but it sounds like there's a couple of glitches. There's some confusion about you can't upgrade just an album or just a song. Right now it's all or nothing. So you just take all the EMI songs on your system times 30 cents and you get one price. But it might be an old song, an old album you're not interested in listening to anymore. So that's a little bit of a glitch. Also, they're going to still hold your username inside of the song. So if you had the ideas that you were going to somehow throw all that now DRM-free music that you purchased up on a file-sharing service, your name is still going to be in there, your Apple username and personal information. Certainly there'll be ways to strip that out, but the point is that it's not quite there, and it's certainly never going to be appropriate to throw that kind of music up on a file-sharing service, but it's a step in the right direction. Personally, I think I'm going to just hang back and wait until all of my music can be converted to DRM-free.
Yeah.
Rather than being an early adopter on this particular thing. But still, I think it's a great move and more brilliance on the part of Steve Jobs.
I agree. And it's ultimately a good business move, too, I think, for everybody.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Also, Apple announced today the iTunes U section of the iTunes Store. Did you see this?
Right, iTunes University.
And this is a place on iTunes that's dedicated to free content such as course lectures, language lessons, lab demonstrations, sports highlights, and campus tours that are provided by U.S. colleges and universities like Stanford, UC Berkeley, Duke University, and MIT.
Wow, you know, that's interesting because I've got a bunch of lectures from MIT that I had downloaded, some of the classic computer science stuff that you can find
right
where somebody filmed from years ago. and they've got a lot of free content up there. And was it Stanford that's got a great deal of free?
Yeah, I think it is Stanford. Well? There's a website where they have just a ton of video content from lectures.
Interestingly, right now on the just at the time of recording, those URLs are broken. I just tried to go to iTunes U and it didn't work. Hmm. Got a 404.
Well, this came out today, so they're either getting hammered or they're fixing bugs, probably. More likely.
Still a fantastic idea.
Yeah.
It's going to make it easier if people can use the iTunes process, the iTunes workflow for putting this data around. And you've already seen a number of universities decide to give away iPods.
Yes.
To say, you know, welcome to the university and here's your free iPod. It's part of the process. People have already kind of informally started to record lectures and things like that. And now they're going to be able to get those things. It's like getting your homework, you know.
Yeah, exactly. And you have a Mac. What kind of Mac do you have?
Okay, so I didn't actually end up buying it. So what's going on is that I borrowed John Lamb's Mac, and I wandered around the Rails conference showing people demos of the dynamic language runtime. And I wanted to borrow his Mac not only because I was excited about the DLR and Silverlight, but because I wanted to see what it was like to really experience a Mac. Now, I do have a Mac Mini, but it's kind of a crappy Mac Mini from 6 months ago. It's not like the super Intel Core 2 Duo. Mm-hmm. But John's is fully loaded, 3 gigs of RAM, Core 2, and I filled it up with all sorts of stuff that I probably shouldn't have because he'll have to uninstall it when he gets it. I put on Parallels and VMware Fusion, and I installed 2 copies of Vista on it, and I've been doing some different tests and stuff. It's the top-of-the-line MacBook Pro that John loaned me. And I went to the Apple store and asked the guy if I should buy, and he said give it a week or two because the Apple Developers Conference, WWDC, is going to be June 11th. And he says, just wait. Whatever you want to buy today is going to drop in price $500. There'll be a new one that'll come out. You probably want that one, is what he said.
Ah.
So I'm considering getting a MacBook Pro. I want to be able to run Vista on it. And I tell you, this Parallels is one of the VM tools that the Apple has. $79. It's kind of their virtual PC. Wow, really fantastic. The thing that's really significant about it is that as a complement to Bootcamp is the dual boot stuff that lets you run Vista on another partition.
Mm-hmm.
You can partition your Mac half and half or whatever you like. So you can have Apple on one, Mac OS X on one partition and Vista on another. But then you can launch into OS X, run a virtual machine, and tell the VM that you want the disk it to use to be the other partition.
Ah.
So you could dual boot, leave something on your desktop, right, like a file,
mm-hmm.
dual boot again, come into OS X, run a VM, and your file's still there.
Wow.
So you can have the native speed running outside of Mac OS X, running Vista natively, and then you can run it in a VM. So I've been using Visual Studio on it, running Orcus, and having a blast. It's a really great Windows laptop. I've been really impressed.
Now, the other thing that was announced today came from Palm and at Shrinkster.com, PI5. Palm introduced some sort of new laptop, Palm Top thing. What is this?
Yeah, they call it the Folio. I think that Ars Technica said it correctly when they said in their recent headline, Palm officially out of ideas introduces 1990s Palm Top.
Yeah.
If you've ever used the Scion or familiar with Scion, PSION, it was a British company, 1991 through 1994, came up with some really amazing stuff.
That was like the significant Newton kind of
yeah,
thing.
Yeah, well, it was the Newton, but it was the anti-Newton. So while Apple was innovating with the Newton doing a slate-style touchscreen, these guys felt it was all about the clam top format. It was a clam shell. Open it up with an almost full-size keyboard. They started out with a small push-button keyboard, and then they came out with the Scion 5, I think it was the 5MX.
Yeah.
That was the one I had. This is like 96. 16 megs of RAM, big wide screen, and it had this amazing little keyboard that kind of came out of nowhere. It folded open. And the Palm Folio is basically a tiny laptop. Remember Windows CE tried to do this. I actually had a little IBM. It looked like a tiny ThinkPad. It was the IBM X41? No. You remember this little tiny thing? It looked like it was a...
I'm trying to forget, actually.
It was like an infant's ThinkPad.
Right.
And it ran... It was gorgeous. I mean, it was a cute little thing. I had one of these. It had 16 megs of RAM, and it ran Windows CE, and it had a little ThinkPad pointer. And it lasted forever. The batteries lasted forever, but it had Pocket Word, and it had Pocket Excel.
Yeah, they're really only telling us the Folio has three features: email, attachments, and web browsing. I mean, those are the details, you know, that they go
right
into. So it's really just an add. They say it's an add-on for your Palm, and they're introducing it at $499. So it's not like a full laptop.
Well, and to be clear, that's $499 after $100 rebate.
Oh, okay. Well, there
so
you
that
go.
Mean, you know, that's they're overtly eating $100 there. So who knows how much it really costs? But it's interesting if you take a phone on the far kind of the far left of an imaginary scale, and you take the desktop replacement super laptop like the one that you've got on the far right of that scale, and you move kind of towards each other, while you've got people coming out with more and more powerful sub-notebooks like the OQO and the Sonys and some of the Fujitsu Lifebooks that are getting smaller and smaller full-featured laptops. You've got the ultra-mobile PCs, the Origami brand, Origami codename PCs from Microsoft.
Yeah.
A bunch of those we saw at Mix. Very, very tiny 10-inch screens, almost look like a Newton, but they run Vista. And that's heading to the left. While on the other side there, from the left, heading off to the right, you've got phones getting more and more and more full-featured. I saw a Verizon phone recently that would flip open vertically and flip horizontally and let you watch television, right?
Yeah, my brother has one. You know, the thing is, I don't think this is going to work because the middle-sized device is not good at doing either very well. You know, the laptop is good when you have a table, a place to sit and work, or you just have a chair, you open it up, you put it on your knees or whatever. And the phone is good if you're just, you know, on the train walking around, you know, in a restaurant, you want to annoy your spouse and your family. You know, I don't think a mid-sized device works well in either of those situations.
Right. I think when a device tries to be a cop-out or a companion, it's relegated immediately to being a niche. I mean, basically they're saying, here's a tiny device that turns on really quick when the screen on your phone is too small. And it works great with the Palm. And if anyone's interested, rather than shipping with support for Windows Mobile and for BlackBerry, we'll leave that up in the air if you care. Seems to me like a more effective thing to do would have been to make it more of a more controversial shape, rather than trying to look like a laptop. I mean, it looks like a tiny laptop.
It does,
with a 10-inch
screen. Therefore you're going to be disappointed when you find out it doesn't have laptop features.
Exactly. So why not make it not look like a laptop? Why not make it look like an 8-inch screen, a companion screen, you know, the Windows Sideshow equivalent?
Right.
Just as Windows Sideshow attempts to be tiny auxiliary devices for and auxiliary screens for your laptop, where's my giant screen? If I've got a phone that already has a keyboard on it, why not give me a quote unquote Bluetooth screen and Bluetooth keyboard? Let the phone be the brain. Let the phone be all the, you know, the computer. Make the phone smarter. The phone's already got 2 gigs of SD card RAM, right? I've got one of these Windows Mobile 6 devices from HTC, and I've got a micro SD card. Have you seen this card? I almost swallowed it.
Yeah, it's very, very tiny.
Way too small. If you don't get it in the device quickly, it'll blow away in the wind. The device, I think, has got a half gig of its own plus the 2 gigs. So there you go, 2.5 gigs in a tiny little device like this. Why do I need another device with screens and batteries and buttons for me to manage? And it runs Linux. I've got a device already. Where's my remote display protocol? Right.
Yeah.
Let that, you know, sell the screen and let it be a companion in that way. Then you might have, you know, imagine just having a screen and a keyboard, a dumb terminal to your phone, which is sitting in your in your bag. You know, Bluetooth remote desktop.
Yep.
This thing just seems like it's neither an organizer nor a laptop. Now we're bad mouthing a device we've never seen, but it sure seems like Palm.
Well, we're bad mouthing the idea. We haven't seen the device.
Sure.
Right.
But that all comes down to this has been done before.
Right. Let's move on to Microsoft Surface. Now, this also was announced today. And was it today or yesterday? I can't remember. But I didn't hear anything about this yesterday, so it must be today. Apparently, there's been a team inside of Microsoft that's been working on this since 2001, according to the website, and they have a timeline, 2001, 2003, 4, 5, and 7. And this is a 30-inch diagonal display table. It's actually a table with a glass tabletop that has a 30-inch monitor, a projector underneath, and sensors on the sides and whatever. It's the Minority Report machine, you know, that you can manipulate with your fingers, with your hands. You take your fingers and diagonally move them in different directions to zoom out. You zoom in by squeezing your fingers together. One feature that I read about was great, that you can take a camera that has a Wi-Fi adapter on it, a digital camera, just place it on the table, and all the pictures just sort of spill out of it onto the screen. Like they have animations of your pictures just oozing out of the place where your camera is and then blowing up and spilling in a series, in like a pile of photos on the
right,
desk.
Right. It introduces a new kind of more obvious metaphor. I mean, I've always tried to explain to family members and non-technical folks that this is your desktop. This is where your stuff lives.
Right.
You know, and try to explain to them the difference between the desktop and the filing cabinet. You know, this is where you put your temporary stuff, and then your more long-term storage stuff goes here.
Yeah.
But that metaphor has always been a bit
abstract. It's too abstract.
It's one level removed, because it's not your finger; it's a mouse pointer.
Right.
So there's your hand on the mouse. The mouse moves the pointer. The pointer does the work.
Yeah.
As opposed to your finger doing the work. That's why I've always kind of preferred the idea of a tablet PC that used my finger rather than a stylus.
I remember being at VBITS, I think it was in the early 90s, when Alan Cooper had just come out with his book About Face, and he asked the audience, what is the best pointing device we have? And somebody, you know, there are a bunch of answers from the audience, and then he just held up his finger. You know, this is what we're talking about. The finger is the best.
It's about making the metaphor natural.
Yeah.
Absolutely. I mean, like around here, you know, CheckFree, the company that just bought us, I saw one of their conference rooms for video conferencing, and you know, you could have a screen with people up on it, showing the people in another room, or you could blow up the entire wall and make it like a virtual portal through there. And then if you could collaborate on that wall, you know, and blur the line of where the computer is, why do we have to look at all of the work that we're trying to accomplish through these tiny through the lenses of these metaphors, as well as these tiny viewports.
Right.
So the idea that rather than having a 15-inch screen or a 17-inch screen, and I have to visualize that this is a desktop, you know, just take that whole monitor and make it your desk. I think that while that sounds cool, what you should see when you look at Surface.com and you should focus on are the ways that could more naturally interact with real things in the world. So like the example you gave, you put a device on the table, and then a circle goes around it to indicate that it's found the device.
Right.
And then you could pick something up. Like you could look at a map, take a number of...
maps would be a fabulous
You could take a number of locations and then pull those locations into the circle where your phone or your PDA lives,
right,
and then they automatically get uploaded into the device. It's a much more natural way of thinking about things. Additionally, you could put a credit card down on the table.
Right.
It could then say, hey, it's Scott. And then I could look at a catalog of things, pull them over to the credit card. They could orbit it like they were in a shopping cart.
Yeah.
And multiple people could potentially do that. So you have this notion of multi-point.
Yeah.
There's a rumor that multi-point technology will be in the next version of OS 10. I think it's codenamed Leopard, meaning multiple people could be manipulating objects on the screen at once.
Right. And this is something that I asked Microsoft for a couple of years ago, a few years ago now, in a blog post that I think got some play and some traction. But anyway, I'm not the first one to think of this, is that, you know, what I wanted the Surface for was mixing, right? I mean, you have audio engineers right now tend to like the hardware mixing desks with the knobs that go up and down because it's tactile. They understand the metaphor. They get it, right? The problem with digital audio mixers is that it's all like on the screen with a mouse, and you can only pull down and move up one fader at one time. So if you're in a live sound situation, you certainly can't use that. What if you're in a live sound situation, you want to record on the computer? Well, you have to now use a outboard gear mixer, but that means that changes the color and the hardware that is processing the audio signal, and it takes it out of the computer. So you're in the analog domain. Well, they have digital mixers too, but that's a different story. So you'd like to be able to just put your hands on the screen and, you know, you got 10 fingers. Let's put 8 of them on different faders and move them all at the same time.
Remember when Bill said, you know, a desktop PC on everyone's desk, a PC on everyone's desk?
Yeah.
If right now they're starting by making this a you know, an entertainment and hotel and casino device,
right.
This
kiosk
seems obvious.
Kind of thing.
People who can afford the $10,000 to make something like this happen, but just as
30,000, I think it was
30,000.
I think so. Yeah.
It doesn't seem like it should be that much, considering that you can buy a 30-inch screen from Apple for $1,200. If I install that into a coffee table and add a touchscreen over the top of it, it shouldn't be $30,000. Well, I think that just means that someday I'll be able to buy a $1,500 coffee table,
yeah,
and make this happen. So I'm just wondering if this means, you know, a coffee table Surface PC in anyone's in everyone's house.
Certainly would be cool.
Have you been up to the Microsoft Research and looked at the Microsoft Home on campus? They've
you
got
know,
this prototype
I didn't,
home.
I was invited to go out there, and Richard went, but I didn't go. I couldn't go. Had to work. But
they've got this great home where they've got a Surface-like experience where you're basically preparing a menu, and you ask for a recipe, and they project it onto your kitchen counter. So you're basically following along with the recipe.
That's awesome.
I mean, you could think that every flat surface in your house could potentially become a screen.
Right.
But then you get into that kind of Idiocracy. There's a movie about that where, you know, when do the banner ads begin?
Right.
When do you start having pop-ups on your wall and advertisement on your kitchen counter?
Yep.
Looks like you're making brownies.
Well, how are we going to wrap up this show? We talked about a few things. They're really sort of disparate things. I guess we could just say, you know, thanks for listening. It's been a minutia-type show again.
Yeah, it is random. Hopefully people don't mind that. Every once in a while, we have these rounding error shows where it's like, it wasn't enough to make a whole show on by themselves. But these are the kinds of things that we're thinking about. And if there's something that you're thinking about that you think we haven't covered, you know, send me an email. You know my email address. It's just scott@hanselman.com, my first name at my last name. Hopefully the spammers won't be able to figure that out with speech-to-text software. But yeah, send me an email or go to my homepage at hanselman.com and send us a note. I know we've got a lot of things in the queue. We're going to talk about ORM. I know that you guys over at .NET Rocks just did some ORM discussion, mm-hmm, object relational mapping. I want to cover that a little bit. Talk a little bit more about what's coming in ASP.NET Orcus, some of the futures that are coming in ASP.NET around Atlas.
Yeah.
I think we're going to probably want to do a JavaScript library smackdown a little bit.
Yeah,
talk
especially
about jQuery, talk about Dojo, yeah, these different libraries like that.
Especially dynamic JavaScript. That's interesting.
What's this?
Dynamic JavaScript. Yeah, manage JavaScript. The DLR.
You're talking about, using basically an ECMAScript running in the browser inside of Silverlight and getting full .NET support.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think that Silverlight as a bridge between managed and unmanaged JavaScript is going to be really interesting. We should probably talk about the future of JavaScript because while Microsoft is off developing things like the DLR, you've got Mozilla talking about including basically a JavaScript compiler, you know, a 100 or 1,000 times faster JavaScript, jitter running inside of Mozilla. So more and more the browser is going to be smart. And if the ECMAScript spec gets ratified, then we're going to be in a really good spot.
Well, that's another show. For now, thanks for listening. And thank you, Scott. And we'll see you next week on Hanselman Minutes.